Sonny, welcome back from the holidays. Did you guys do anything exciting?
Well, it was my baby's first Christmas, so it was exciting to me. Oh, yeah,
that's right. How did that go?
Good. He had no idea what was going on, but I did get a cute little video of me forcing him to rip open a present, so it was good. It was good for mommy. How was yours?
Forcing young children to do things against their will is really great.
Isn't that all what parenting is, Tim?
Yes, mostly it is, yeah.
I seek my parenting advice from you.
Very nice Christmas. And in between Christmas and New Year's, the family and I went to Iceland, as we were just talking about. And it was quite an experience. It's like being on another planet over there. Crazy.
You had the craziest pictures.
I'll talk more about that at another time. We have a really good show today, an excellent guest, which you would come to expect because this is the Line Drive Podcast. Bringing in that guest now, who has been all over the news, one of the biggest stories, certainly of the new year, but of the last, I'd say, 6 months or so, has been this fiasco going on at Harvard, but to a lesser extent at the University of Pennsylvania and MIT. And at the forefront of the Claudine Gay story, the now former president of Harvard, who got caught up in a whole bunch of stuff, including this gigantic plagiarism scandal, the work of the Free Beacon, Aaron Sabarium of the Free Beacon, star reporter there who has made a name for himself nationally over this. We welcome you, Aaron, to the show. Thanks very much for making time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into this Claudine Gay story, which is just insane how this all worked out, tell me a little bit about your background. How did you become to become a reporter at the Free Beacon?
Sure. So I went to Harvard's rival school, Yale, for college. Sorry, I am one of those pointy head elites. I know it's terrible. I was there during the time that the Halloween costume Nicholas Christakis cultural appropriation controversy happened. I was actually the opinion editor of the school newspaper, so I came into college a kind of normal moderate Democrat and was kind of radicalized by seeing how insane some leftists on campus were. It didn't result in an immediate conversion per se, but I think it certainly did push me a little more towards the right, especially having to deal with the insanity up close from my perch at the paper. And then after college, I worked at a small magazine, now defunct magazine called The American Interest, worked as an editor. Then I went over to the Free Beacon, started there as an editor, but pretty quickly decided that it would be more valuable to just do reporting full time. Boss basically said, yeah, you know, you're a smart guy. Why don't you try your hand at reporting? See how it goes. Okay. I would say it's gone pretty well the past just a little over 2 years maybe. Because I started as a reporter. It's been more like 3 years. I'm sorry. It's 3 years. So the most recent scoop was the Claudine Gay stuff.
A lot of reporters will go entire careers without a scoop of this prominence. I mean, for anybody who hasn't been paying attention over the last month, really, when this all started, this all began when the presidents of three schools, Harvard, MIT, and Penn, appeared at a congressional hearing, and Elise Stefanik asked them if calling for the genocide of Jews by groups on campus, would that have violated the student code of conduct? And not one of the three of them were able to actually answer that question in the obvious way, which was, yeah, if you call for the mass murder of a group of people, sure, that violates the student code of conduct. But it wasn't long before, now the University of Pennsylvania president, Liz McGill, she resigned just 4 days after that hearing in early, first, second week of December. But it wasn't long that before Claudine Gay got embroiled in a plagiarism scandal, which is where you come in. So how did this all come about? How did you start looking into this? Tell me what your reporting was like as we led up to this, to the big moment when she resigned.
Yeah. Well, I can't really comment on sources. So parts of the story will have to remain murky. But suffice it to say, I received, a tip about this in early December, around the same time as her congressional testimony. And I was like, wow, that's, if this is true, that's really crazy. So I did start digging into it, analyzed about 29 possible cases of plagiarism for the first story. We only published in the first batch, maybe about 12. We, you know, went through the work, found the exact passages from Gay, looked at what citations there were, weren't, and then went back to the relevant works from which she had lifted language or from which she had heavily paraphrased, and just verified basically that this, that there were these kind of side-by-side comparisons, and then asked, basically showed the side-by-side comparisons to a bunch of people and said, is this plagiarism? And most people said some version of yes. There was disagreement about how severe it was, or whether every single case constituted plagiarism, but everyone said that at least a couple of the examples we had found were pretty clear-cut violations of scholarly norms. So then we published a story, then there were more allegations, we reported on those too, and then there were even more allegations after that, which we reported on the evening of January 1st. And by before noon the next day, Claudine Gay had resigned.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Tim, we had the same line of thought right there. You know, this whole situation just completely blew up, as it should have, because they, these presidents, to me, just the elitist mentality that they have in, well, I can really say whatever I want to, and I'm not going to be held accountable for it, because they haven't been held accountable by the media. They're able to get away with whatever they want to say, whenever they want to say it. But I'm really curious, have you gotten any pushback from other reporters or trolls online? I'm sure you've had some trolls on Twitter. Have you gotten any pushback from people after your reporting has come out on this?
More from commentators on Twitter than from actual reporters, to be frank. I mean, once CNN and the New York Times and other places started picking up the story, I actually think they did a pretty good job of analyzing the examples, corroborating our reporting, and talking to a wide spectrum of people, some of whom defended Gay, but plenty of others did not, or at least said that there was cause for concern here. So I actually think this is a story where, yes, it's telling that the mainstream media didn't jump on it and it came from conservative media at first. But once the mainstream media got on it, which really only took about a week or 10 days, they did a pretty good job. Obviously, there's vitriol online, but I don't really care. Some people were asking me, like, have you been getting these horrible messages? And I was like, yeah, like, probably. But to be honest, I've been, you know, I was busy reporting on Claudine Gay's plagiarism. Yeah, I was working over the holidays. So I was like, hey, you know, I just don't really have time to worry about this between Christmas celebrations and reporting on plagiarism, you know.
Yeah.
That's a full schedule for anybody. Let me ask you about that, because, you know, I've been doing political communications for a long time, and it seems to me that it happens a lot, that there are frequently there are stories that break in conservative media, but because it was broken by conservative media, that's automatically an excuse for the mainstream to not touch it, to never even acknowledge that it exists. So I'm thinking, of course, I lived through this, Hogan and Sonny lived through this, 2020, Hunter Biden's laptop. The mainstream media decided they weren't going to touch it. It was a story that lived only in conservative media, and it never jumped the fence. The real contents of the laptop, that is. So what about this story? I mean, this could have been one where you could have been writing all this stuff in the Washington Free Beacon about all these accusations of plagiarism against the president of Harvard, and it very well could have stayed right there. Why is this different? Was it the added touch of how poorly the hearing had gone when they couldn't denounce the anti-Semitism on campus, or what about this made it different? What about this made it breakthrough?
I think there were a few factors. I obviously the hearing played a role, because you saw that even many liberals were pretty disturbed, I think, by the hearing. Even those included, like me, frankly, who thought that some of the answers they gave were legally correct or were technically correct descriptions of Harvard policy on free speech, you know, nobody thinks that they handled the questions well from a PR standpoint, right? They obviously did not come across well. So I think that did play a role. I also would say that candidly, I think our reporting, the substance was obviously very damning, but so was the presentation, right? We made these really good graphics that showed the side-by-side text in a way that was just very hard to ignore. You know, I think that turned up the pressure on the mainstream media. It wasn't, you know, with Hunter Biden's laptop, I, look, obviously all the crap about it, how it was Russian disinformation, that was silly, but, you know, it wasn't like you could just look at it and say, oh, yep, here's the picture, it's authentic. Right here, there was no way that you could, right,
fair enough,
you could say, oh, well, maybe it's a Russian information op. It was just like, you can look up her paper and you can look up this other paper and go to the pages that we're telling you to go to, and you will see exactly the parallels that we're highlighting here. So I think that was the second factor. And then I think there's actually a third factor, which is that a lot of journalists, for better or worse, were educated at these schools and thus take a natural interest in the controversy at their own alma maters. And so even if in this particular case, the scandal was kind of, or the story was right-wing coded because it painted the progressive president of Harvard in an unflattering light, the reality is that for all the media reporters who, the reporters at the Washington Post, New York Times, what have you, who sneer maybe at, oh, why do conservatives care about the elite schools? The reality is that all of the people at the New York Times care about these elite schools because they went to those elite schools. So I think that's the other factor here. And look, you know, and I've reported on a lot of campus controversies, and although this is probably the biggest one in certain ways, it's not the only time that this has broken into the mainstream. I did something on, I had a few reports on Yale Law School that were picked up by, you know, mainstream liberal columnists at the Washington Post who basically sided with me and said, yeah, this looks pretty bad. Same thing happened with Stanford Law School when there was a very well-publicized shout-down of a conservative federal judge. So, you know, if the reporting is good and it involves the schools that people went to, I think that often actually is enough to overcome the kind of tribal partisan bias. Not always, but in my experience, it has been.
Amazing. I'm going to guess this is the first time you've caused an Ivy League president to resign, however.
Yes, first time I've caused an Ivy League president to resign. Not the first time I've, though, caused an Ivy League or similarly elite administrator to resign. I mean, the Yale Law reporting resulted in one person taking an early retirement, which was widely understood to be a kind of ouster, and another person being reassigned to another role. And the Stanford reporting basically did result in the firing of the diversity dean, Tyrion Steinbach. So it's, people have been like, oh, this is your first scalp. And no, it's my fourth scalp. It's just the biggest one.
But it's the biggest one, right.
So, Aaron, I really appreciate this. This is so fascinating to me. And I want to go down a road. You hit on a couple of the reasons why. I do think because of the war and the protests you've seen on campus as it relates to Israel and Palestine, other things, the scrutiny and the focus are on a lot of these schools. What are they teaching? What are they doing? And so when this comes forward, the byproduct of that is, let's take a look at the people who are at the helm, the people who are trying to lead these institutions. So I think that's fascinating you bring that up. But you hit on something there about the defense of this. And I think this is kind of interesting to me because, yeah, I would imagine journalists want to defend, like they defended Bill Clinton because they were all boomers, right? They like that time period. They like his age. They were all kind of part of the same group. It's the same thing here. They want to defend it because it's their institutions. These are the elite institutions that they uphold as being such bastions of greatness and integrity, et cetera, et cetera. So they want to rally around that. But also because of the race and gender of Ms. Gay, that's part of it too, I think. So my question is, people who have come out now vehemently and tried to say this is all because of race or all because of her gender or whatever, they've been crushed, just skull dragged on Twitter over this whole thing, right? Because it's just insane. You said it. You compare the old text, you compare her text, it's clear cases of plagiarism and tens of 20s of 30s of instances of this. It's not one once or twice, it's a bunch of times. So a long way to get to my question here. Yeah, the early clapback here is it's race or it's gender or whatever. So two parts. One is, why do you think they tried to cram that defense of her into something that clearly had nothing to do with race? Because, I mean, she got her job, you know, in a lot of ways. She was touted as the first African-American, the first woman, right? So why do they go to that first, I guess? And then second is, why do you think it just failed?
Can I, before you answer that question, let me play exactly what Hogan's talking about. This is Maragay, not no relation, from the New York Times editorial board on MSNBC. This is a quick clip. Mm-hmm.
So this is really an attack on academic freedom. It's an attack on people who are pluralists and believe that you should bring people from all over the world together. This is an attack on diversity. This is an attack on multiculturalism. The fact that she's a black woman and the first person who is a black American to lead Harvard only added to their thirst to dethrone her. And, you know, those attacks, I don't have to say that they're racist because you can hear and see the racism in the attacks.
Not an attack on plagiarism, by the way. Not an attack on plagiarists. Let's be clear.
I can't.
So to get back into Hogan's question, there's somebody from the New York Times editorial board talking about you, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you asked why that was their first go-to response and then why it didn't work. Well, there's probably a number of reasons why they responded that way. One, it's just easy. Two, it's impossible to defend her on the substance. So they have to attack the motives of the people who they claim are attacking her. I mean, I wouldn't characterize my reporting as an attack so much as just reporting facts, but fair enough. I think the other thing too is that these institutions are not used to rigorous scrutiny. And I've seen this not just with Harvard, but with Stanford and Yale and Princeton for that matter too, and other places I've reported on. They are bad at media. And you wouldn't think that because they are very image conscious. They love their reputation. They hate negative press. But they, I think, are so cosseted in their ivory towers that they don't understand how the rest of the country sees them, how certain things look. And as a result, because they sort of fail the ideological turning test, they are just really horrible at knowing how and whether to respond to reporters' inquiries. And they don't spin these stories well. And my sense is that because they're in an environment where, oh, that's racist works as a kind of argument ender, they think that that's going to work when a reporter comes to them with serious allegations of plagiarism. But it just doesn't. And part of the reason that they don't realize it doesn't is that they are just too in their own world. Now, why that reply ultimately didn't work here, it's mostly, I think, the strength of the reporting and the fact that just it was easy to see through. The other thing I would say is that it's just not a credible argument in this case because Liz McGill faced more pressure, arguably, than Claudine Gay, right? There was an organized donor revolt at UPenn, which really did not happen to the same degree or with the same level of organization and coordination at Harvard, right? And then McGill resigns within days of the testimony after releasing this pathetic, it looked almost like a hostage video where she says, I actually do condemn calls for genocide and it doesn't work. She's out of there in 48 hours.
She didn't even survive the bad hearing. And
right. And Claudine Gay did. Yes.
Yeah, she did. She survived that first damage. Mm-hmm. And made her, if it not for the plagiarism, she'd still be president of Harvard, no question.
Right. So just, you know, if it were the case that this had been motivated by racism, and that these university administrators, you know, are racist themselves or willing to capitulate to racists. Well, okay, if that were true, we would expect to see Claudine Gay be the first to go and Liz McGill hang on longer. But that's exactly the opposite of what we saw, which indicates that theory just isn't true. Yeah, and, you know, I also think that even without the hearing, it's an open question whether this would have sunk, the plagiarism on its own would have sunk her. It's not obvious it would have, but it's also not obvious to me that it would not have, because part of what happened here, right, is that faculty started saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we refer students to the Honor Council for this. This is pretty hard to defend, this pattern. The faculty were really angry that the Harvard Corporation was not forthcoming about the results of its initial investigation. And, you know, I think they felt blindsided when they found out, wait, the Harvard Corporation secretly threatened the New York Post and tried to squash this. Wait, you know what? Like, this was not, we thought you, the way I think Harvard sort of spun it was, oh, these were really minor, it's not a big deal. And then they found out, oh, Harvard Corporation is lying through their teeth. And so that, I think, eroded faculty support. Maybe even more consequential than that, though, was the erosion in student support. I mean, you saw students coming out there saying, look, we get in trouble for this. Like, what the hell are you doing saying this isn't a big deal when we're told that our entire academic careers can be over if we miss a few footnotes in a class? You know, and some people would say, well, they don't get suspended for if they do, you know, some of these more minor cases. They just have to rewrite the assignment or fail the class. That's still a pretty serious sanction for an undergrad, right? Failing a class is a big deal. And, you know, no one was saying, or most people were not saying, strip the president of Harvard of tenure and completely fire her. The question was, should this person be the figurehead, the president of the entire institution? And I just think that's pretty hard to defend once these cases of plagiarism come.
Yeah. Hogan, did you have something you wanted to add before?
Yeah, just one more thing. I don't remember what the term she used was, but I do find it funny. Remember when there were two consecutive quarters of negative growth or whatever, and it's whatever the technical definition of recession is. And remember, Karine Jean-Pierre from the podium says, no, it's not a recession. And she gives some other explanation. And then someone said, are you trying to redefine the word recession? She's like, no, it's not a redefinition. So she redefined recession and then redefined the word redefine. similarly here, it was like, this is plagiarism. And they were like, oh, no, it's not plagiarism. It's failure to cite or whatever little weird amalgam.
Right.
And I was like, it's so funny when they get caught doing something like this, they just change the definition. Like, it's not racism. Or it's racism. Well, no, it's not. But no, what racism really means, someone gets caught breaking the law and then you punish them. Well, that's not, you know what I mean? It's like they're always trying to change the definition to suit whatever argument. And did you, in that moment when they started redefining the word plagiarism, were you just like, what are you talking about? This is a textbook definition.
Well, we made sure to quote their euphemisms extensively so that the public could see exactly what they were saying and, you know, make up their own minds about whether inadequate citation or duplicative language without attribution is in any meaningful respect distinct from plagiarism.
Duplicative language, that's what it was.
Yeah.
That's great.
Oh, man. Well, Aaron, you have done such an outstanding job with this whole investigative reporting that you've done, your articles, all of it is just outstanding. And I'm very thankful that there are people like you that still exist that have a general curiosity to keep leaders and people in leadership positions held accountable for things they say and things they do. I'm just wondering, does it pique your interest in other school leaders, maybe other public schools or big schools like UNC or Duke or other state schools?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people were saying on Twitter, oh, they're only going after her because she's a black woman.
Right.
They wouldn't be searching. Believe me, if someone finds examples of plagiarism in the writings of any Ivy League president, believe me, I would like to know about it. And I have said before, my DMs are open. If someone else did something similar to this, please let me know. Yeah, it is really funny how some of the critics of this story and of me implicitly are so ideologically blinkered that they don't understand that, of course, I would be happy if someone gave me another scoop like this. Like,
yeah. There was a guy on Twitter who said, you better be ready to go look at all university presidents. And there's like a thousand.
Oh, I think we should. And,
yeah.
And
oh, look, your terms are acceptable.
Yeah. And if, and look, if okay. we should, and frankly, you know, if it did turn out that this was just rampant in everyone's academic writing, then okay, maybe the norms about plagiarism need to change and we need to have a conversation about what the standard should be. Fine. Like, that you can make that argument if you want, but before making that argument, you have to actually establish that the stuff really is rampant throughout every other, you know, similarly situated academic's work, and it's not clear to me that it is. And B, okay, but then we gotta, you can't be holding students to different standards. I mean, it's gotta be the same standard for everyone. So
yeah, the first thing they tried to do is lower the, what it was they were talking about. Like you're saying, Matt Egan, who's a reporter from CNN, he actually went on the air and said that she wasn't accused of anything serious, like, you know, stealing somebody's ideas. She just stole the words that people use to express those ideas. Right. So this was like his defense of her. But when you're talking about, they're implicitly talking about you and criticizing you, I think Jonathan Chait, I don't know if you saw his, you probably did, piece in the New York Times magazine.
Not sure if I've read it yet, but I saw he wrote something.
Yeah. So basically what he's saying is, sure, they're right. And yes, this is plagiarism. And yeah, it warrants a resignation. But the people who brought it to light, my gosh, these are, and he's talking about Christopher Rufo and you implicitly, that they can't argue with the facts of the story, but they sure do dislike the people who brought it to light. So what's your reaction to that? They're like shooting the messenger, but not the message.
Yeah, it's silly. I mean, it's silly. The motivation doesn't change the truth of the story. I would also say too that look, I mean, people, Rufo in particular is a polarizing figure, and people don't like that he sort of said on Twitter, I'm going to do exactly this, mwahaha, and it's like, oh, see, he's an evil villain. Okay, fine. I think it is actually telling that people keep bringing him up to kind of smear the motives and don't bring me up by name as much, because, A, I haven't really, you know, said anything quite as explicit as Rufo, and B, you know, I don't know. I think it's pretty clear that my motives are first and foremost to do the accurate, honest reporting. And sure, obviously, you know, I have my own ideological priors, and that informs what I am interested in covering and what I choose to focus on. But, you know, like, come on. I mean, also this notion that it's only because of the anti-Semitism hearing. Again, even if that had never happened, if someone told, you know, said, hey, here's a credible tip that the president of Harvard or any other Ivy League school is a serial plagiarist, obviously I would look into that, right? Yeah.
Do you think the idea that it's only
because of the hearing is just ridiculous.
Do you think those people, her detractors, were waiting and there was blood in the water because of the hearing and they thought, this is our moment and now let's come forward with these plagiarism facts that we've got?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really comment or speculate about different people's motivations, but I'm sure that there obviously was more scrutiny on her because of the hearing. I mean, no one would deny that, but that's also, look, that's how these things work, right? There was more scrutiny on Richard Nixon because Mark Feld, the guy who was later outed as Deep Throat, wanted a promotion at the FBI and thought that by leaking things, he would embarrass the FBI director, and then he'd be promoted to FBI director. That wasn't some pure-hearted motive, but it resulted in the surfacing of real information about the Watergate scandal. I don't think the Washington Post was just, you know, some neutral, unbiased view from nowhere source that had absolutely no opinions of its own about Richard Nixon. But, you know, that doesn't mean that Woodward and Bernstein's reporting on Nixon was false. And by the same token, right, nobody seriously believes that the New York Times is totally unbiased and isn't out to get Donald Trump. But look, like, the New York Times will report things about Donald Trump that are both unflattering and true. it happens, right? So this notion that because a reporter or an activist or what have you might, you know, be cheering on the demise of someone for partisan reasons, well, even if that is the case, you know, if that's the standard, then we basically just have to ignore every story published in the mainstream media about Donald Trump. And I don't think that's really a precedent that a lot of Claudine Gay's defenders would like to set.
Yeah. I mean, does it have to be stated that you probably can't use plagiarism as a weapon against someone who is not a plagiarist? Because, I mean, isn't that basically...
Yeah. Weaponizing plagiarism allegations. That's the new one.
Well, it's also interesting that it's the white supremacists who somehow went back in a DeLorean 26 years and forced her to plagiarize all these different papers. It's all the white supremacist fault in some way. It just doesn't make any, it doesn't make any sense. So I think you're right. It's kind of a merging of so many different things going on at one given time that allowed people to kind of look into this and go, wait a minute, this is serious. It's real. What are we going to do about it? And I'll be honest, I can't believe they actually ousted her. I'll be honest. Regardless of the evidence, I've just seen the left. I've seen the media circle the wagons too many times on something like this. I know Tim touched on the laptop. He and I are both still extremely bitter on that, so we won't go into that. But I still see what you're saying is a lot of things fell into place here, and it was kind of unavoidable. Yeah. I just wish I wish other things were as unavoidable, but this is one I think that was significant.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised too. Actually, I wasn't that surprised that she resigned, but I was surprised that she resigned so quickly. I thought she'd hold on for maybe a year and then resign quietly.
A year? But, wow.
Well, but, you know, but actually I wasn't so surprised. That was what I thought maybe in late December or like mid to late December. Then as more surfaced, I heard more kind of off the record from faculty saying, yeah, her support has really collapsed. Then I started to think she might be out of there sooner. But yeah, look, I was when I first started pursuing this story, I was not expecting her to resign within a month of me publishing anything.
Well, you've done amazing work. Yeah. Aaron Sabarium, we thank you for your journalistic efforts, and we thank you for your time here today. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Great work, Aaron.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonny. Thank you, Hogan. I'm Tim Murtaugh, and this has been the Line Drive Podcast.